For some people, making art is a way of life.
I can't remember a time when I wasn't drawing. I can't not draw. That is just how I relate with the world.
This is Molly Crabapple. She's an artist and a journalist, and she's been making art her entire life.
When I'm happy, I draw. When I'm sad, I draw. When I'm bored, I draw. It is just, it's my language.
And the thing is, we all start out that way, right? I mean, pretty much from the time we can walk, we're scribbling with crayons and magic markers. We draw stick figures with giant heads and big, fat, happy, smiling suns. We cover sidewalks with chalk. We fill whole notebooks with dragons and fairy princesses and mean, angry monsters. But then for some reason, somewhere along the way, most of us just stop. We seem to lose the impulse to make art. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and today, on To the Best of Our Knowledge, what can we learn from the people who didn't stop?
The drawing, the act of that discipline is like a life preserver. It's like, even when you're physically beaten down or even when you're depressed or anything, if you can just hang on to this, you can hang on. That discipline can be the most powerful thing in the world.
For Molly Crabapple, art is a political tool. It's a form of action, even a kind of investigative journalism. With her pen and her sketchbook, she's documented the Arab Spring, the war in Syria, court proceedings at Guantanamo. Her work has been published in Vanity Fair, Vice, and the New York Times, and it also hangs in the Museum of Modern Art. Her new memoir, Drawing Blood, is the story of how she came of age as an artist and as a radical.
I had been protesting for a long time. I come from a very political household. I spent a lot of time protesting against the Iraq War. But there was a sense with those Iraq War protests that even if we had 500,000 people on the street in New York, this was absolutely futile. Power could have shrugged. It did not matter. And with Occupy, this was something that was actually threatening to power. Even though there were many, many less people, this was something that actually presented a challenge. And knew it presented a challenge because cops were pepper spraying people in the face all the time and kettling them and arresting them for nothing.
And this was the early days of the Occupy movement, and you were living across the street from Zuccotti Park at the time.
Yes. And I was like, these people are being so brave, and they're standing for things that I agree with. And my first sort of thing, forays, were that they had these bail funds for live streamers and journalists who had been arrested, and so I started just selling my work to raise money for the bail funds. And then I also started documenting the protesters there. And it was because like the media had this caricature of it where they were like, oh, these are just flaky hippies, spoiled kids. They don't know anything. And then I go down there and it's a bunch of union guys and grandmas and, you know, veterans. And I'm like, this is a lie. This is a lie that is being told in the media about it. This is a slander. And so I wanted to use my art and use my platform to show the people who are actually there.
It's interesting because, you know, this is the iPhone age. That protest is, you know, probably one of the most photographed in history. The internet is full of thousands of images of it. What can an artist, what can a sketch or a drawing add?
This is something that gets so to the core of why I do what I do. Because I sometimes, you know, as an artist, you think, what is the point of this? Am I like, just doing some sort of obscure hobby like blacksmithing or whittling or painting china? Is this just like my quirky little craft that I do to keep myself busy until I die? Like, why am I doing this, man? And I think that in a world where every event, as you said, is so documented, where every time a cop beats someone up, there are 25,000 pictures of it, that what those pictures do, in addition to all the positive things that they do, is that they can make people numb. It's like an information overload. And so art has the advantage of being slow, right? Like when you take an iPhone picture, it's half a second. When you do a painting, it's a month maybe. And by imbuing something with your attention in that way, you're telling everyone else that they have to imbue it with that same sort of attention.
Do you have visual memories that come to mind? You know, if I just name a protest, I don't know, Istanbul or Athens, Syntagma Square, are there visual memories that just jump into your mind?
In Istanbul, the protest that I was at was by soccer fans. Now, a lot of the soccer fans, they're, you know, organized into local leagues like Galatasaray or Fenerbahce or Çarşı, which is the fan group for the Beşiktaş team. And during the Gezi protests, they were extremely political. They formed the front lines of the protests. They were astoundingly brave. And so this protest that I went to, it was entirely soccer fans from all of the different leagues. They're there with their colors. And the police have sort of had like a confrontation with them, and the police have their big water cannon. And the guys have like masked up. They've put their team mask, their team scarves. They wrap them around their face. And this one guy is just like standing in the center, and he's holding a flare in his hand. And I mean, it's just like this classic pose. Like it's the same pose that the Statue of Liberty has, you know, the one person with the torch. But it's this young member of Charshi holding up a flare with his face all masked up while they chant "fuck the police."
Is there a relationship, do you think, between art and activism?
There can be. I think it's not a surprise that many artists are attracted to ecstatic protests because those do have that magical element. Of course, so much of the best activism is actually the very boring organizing that us artists have routinely been quite bad at. But that's actually the sort of thing that creates the machinery for change. But I mean, art can be activism because art can be about every single human experience. Art can be about love and war and hate. Art can be kissing the ass of some like rich oligarch in order to, you know, get his money. Art can be about, you know, making a gesture in support of striking steelworkers. Art can be anything because art is a means of human expression.
Because we were talking about ecstatic protest, and I guess what that line suggests to me is the joyousness of protest, which, reading your chapters about the Occupy movement, it just seems like there was a lot at stake and there was a lot of anger, but it also seems like for you in particular, it was a kind of joyous time. Your life was full of friends who were coming and going, and it was a protest, but it was kind of a party.
I think that's something that's very in common to people around the world. I have friends who were very involved in the Egyptian protest, many of whom have been forced to leave the country since. And they describe it pretty universally as the greatest time in their lives.
Is that a good thing or not a good thing? I mean, is there a danger of idealizing what was actually a really pivotal political moment?
If your politics doesn't have joy, what sort of world are you building? I mean, it can't only be about joy, but if it doesn't have joy, then I don't know what you can possibly construct without that.
Yeah, what's the Emma Goldman line? If I can't dance, I don't want to be part of your revolution.
Exactly.
So your book begins and also ends at Guantanamo, sitting in courtrooms, watching trials, visiting prisons. What are your main memories? What images hit you most strongly during your time at Guantanamo?
Oh, there are so many. I went to Guantanamo twice. One was for the pretrial hearings of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and then one was for the little Potemkin tour of the prison. The thing about Guantanamo is the place where our fetishization of the ideal of freedom smacks most brutally against the various ways that we have intensely violated that. I mean, Guantanamo is a place where 800 men have passed through, only 7 of which have been found guilty of any crime, whose motto is honor bound to defend freedom. And it's written everywhere. You know, freedom, 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 defend freedom. You know, this is like the chorus of Guantanamo Bay. And this is a place where
– it's a prison.
When I was there – yeah, it's a prison. And it's not just a prison. It's a prison for people who haven't been charged with anything. And when I was there, the majority of people were hunger striking because they wanted they wanted to know how long they were going to be there and when they were going to see their families again. And so because of the hunger strike, they were being shackled to a chair twice a day and having a tube forced down their nose into the stomach and having protein shake pumped through the tube. And they were doing this in buildings that were labeled honor bound to defend freedom.
Did they take you on a tour through the place? I mean, did you see that chair?
They did. They took us to the hospital. And this was what was so disturbing about Guantanamo. It's this mutilation of language that happens there. So they take you to the hospital and there's the force feeding chair and the tubes and the whole setup. And there's this very like handsome doctor who, because people don't use their real names there because of security, all of the doctors had been given Shakespearean pseudonyms. So there was like Nurse Juliet and Dr. Mercutio. And I believe it was... Is it Dr. Mercutio? So Dr. Mercutio, he is passing around this tube that they shove through men's noses into their stomach. And he's like, oh, it's such a small tube, you know, and this is a legitimate medical procedure. It's called e-feeding. And they would not use the word force feeding because they know that everyone knows that. And so they tried to make up another term for it. And everything in Guantanamo is like that. It's not, you know, locking people up forever without charge. It's, you know, indefinite detention. It's not torture, enhanced interrogation. It's not shackles. It's humane three-point restraint. Every single thing not only is horrifying, but it has this Orwellian language overlay to it.
So what art did you make out of your visit to Guantanamo?
I just drew daily life as best I could there. And one of the things that I had a real advantage of as an artist is that there's really strict censorship there. So if you're a photographer, they'll give you all these rules of what you can and can't photograph. Like you can't photograph anyone's faces. You can't photograph a certain number of doors. You can't photograph a certain number of cameras, of walls, whatever. You know, before you know it, the only thing you can photograph is the floor. And it's really, really hard to get good photos of Guantanamo. I think, you know, many people may have noticed that there is a paucity of great photojournalism of Guantanamo. And it's not because many great people haven't been there. It's just because the military looks through your phone and will delete things from it. So because I'm an artist, when they told me, like, oh, you can't draw people's faces, I just drew these, like, masks where their faces were. Because I wanted to make the censorship very explicit. I wanted everyone to know that I was being censored.
So what are you working on now?
It's funny. I've been on the road so much with this book and with, like, journalism stuff that I've really, really, really missed all my friends. Yeah. And so they're kind of obsessive. I do, like, a ton of little portraits of them, usually on, like, just, you know, the junk paper you pick up on the road, like receipts or plane tickets or hotel stationery. And then I collage all that as a background. And then I do these, like, giant paintings of them on top of it. And then they write on top of that. So it's like this attempt to get their soul. And it's really because I miss them, because it's like the last piece was, like, on the Istanbul bombing. Like, I'm doing, you know, kind of depressing stuff. And I just, you know, want to do something that's about, like, love.
Molly Crabapple is an artist and writer. She's a contributing editor for Vice, and her work is in the permanent collection of the Museum of Modern Art. Her new memoir is called Drawing Blood. So the same year that Molly began documenting Occupy protesters with pen and ink, across the ocean, another artist, Egyptian graffiti artist Bahia Shahab, was putting her art and her personal safety on the line. Now, this was during the massive Cairo demonstrations against the Mubarak regime, and Bahia was looking for a way to add her own voice to those protests. So she began spraying graffiti on the walls of buildings. Not a big complicated design, just one simple word in Arabic. No. No to military rule. No to emergency law. No to burning books. No to killing. Bahia's art became a rallying cry during that revolution. And she stopped by our studio recently to talk with Charles Monroe Kane.
So, you know, take me back. It was 2011. Egypt's in the midst of a revolution. You choose to do graffiti. Why graffiti over, say, I don't know, protesting in the streets?
Because I've always been a very quiet person and I can't scream. And even though everybody was demonstrating, I found the best way I can participate is by spraying stencils on the street. So...
Now, before we move on, because I was trying to picture this, is how did you do it?
So you just select a design and then cut it out on a piece of cardboard and you spray it with a spray can. And the best time to spray, actually, is during demonstrations because there's so much going on that nobody notices what you're doing. That or 4 in the morning. So 4 in the morning is a very good time to spray, too.
I have a question about 4 in the morning because when you were out at 4 a.m., and you had been caught with the spray paint and stencils, what would have happened to you?
I've had friends who were detained. You would obviously be detained and they would charge you. And then based on your luck and how much money you have, you can get released. But in my case, as a woman, we could face even worse treatment. So it's really, it depends on your luck. It can vary from being caught in jail to being raped and killed, so, and everything in between. So,
how do you justify for yourself at that moment to make that worth it?
I have 2 daughters. So I want to leave them with a better country.
But there must have been a time when it was your first time. So the revolution's starting to happen, or things are really happening, and you decided, okay, I'm going out, I'm going to do this. What was it like the first time you put that paint on the wall?
Oh, it was amazing. It was really liberating because the first stencil I sprayed was "No to Military Rule." So it was really very liberating because it was like, I can finally scream now. This is my own way of voicing my opinion.
I'm curious about your choice. I know there are a lot of words in what you did, but the main word is no. Why no?
So because it's a project that started in 2010. I was invited to participate in an exhibition commemorating 100 years of Islamic art in Europe, and the curator's only condition was to create an artwork using the Arabic language. And to me, I, as a woman living in the world in 2010, I only had one thing I wanted to say, and it was no. And in Arabic, to confirm the no, we say no and 1,000 times no. So I started looking for 1,000 different no's on everything ever produced under Islamic or Arab patronage in the past 1,400 years. And this was the artwork. So it was a book documenting the evolution of the word no in Arabic.
So then, as the revolution starts to happen, you have all these no's available to stencil.
Like ammunition. Yeah, these were my bullets. So every time I wanted to say no to something, I would take a form and add a message to it and spray it on the street.
So you have these stencils, you're going around with spray paint, you're adding the words underneath or above that go along with them. Then what happens next?
They get erased very quickly.
or changed, or altered, or tagged over as well, right?
Yes, yes. There was a really interesting conversation going on the walls of Cairo during the revolution. So you would spray something, another artist would come and add to the comment, or I would tag other people's walls who don't have words but have nice drawings. So I would add my nose to their paintings. So it was a really very interesting conversation.
I want to ask about one of your stencils, and it was the one with the... I don't know what to call it other than the no with the blue bra.
Yes, it's the blue bra stencil. It's a very famous incident. At a point, demonstrators were on the street, and this young woman, she was one of the demonstrators, and she was caught by the military, and they were beating her up. And this is all on video. And when they were pulling her, they stripped open her abaya and revealed her blue bra. And we never saw her face, but she became famous as the blue bra protester because of that incident. But the brutality of the soldiers who were pulling her and stepping on her, because of that incident, there were mass rallies by women activists on the street. So I just commemorated that by simplifying the blue bra and spraying it on the street to remind people of what happened.
I'm curious, and this isn't meant as a criticism, but when I'm thinking about your nose, I was thinking of a story when Yoko Ono met John Lennon. Do you know the story? And she had an art exhibit, and there was a big, huge ladder. And on top of the ladder was a little piece of paper, a magnifying glass. He climbs up the ladder and looks at it, waiting for some artist symbol of something negative. And instead it said yes, in real small letters, the magnifying glass. You didn't know, which I respect. Why not yes?
Because I really have a lot of things to say no to. Now I found myself going back to the no again. So last year I started spraying the no in every city I visit around the world because I can no longer spray in Cairo. So I sprayed in Freiburg in Germany and in New Orleans. I've also sprayed in Vancouver and in New York. And so I will be spraying the no again because this is where we're back to. This is what we're back to.
And how does that make you feel?
I think now at least I can express myself. The geography is no longer relevant because I have cyberspace. So if I don't have access to my city, there are many other welcoming cities where I can still share how I feel and what I think.
Is the no for your people or is it for everybody?
I think now it has become, especially when I went to Germany, it was after the extremist reactions that was last year. So I think it's more of a human message. So no, I mean, I don't know why. I mean, humanity is still not getting these basic concepts like no to war and no to blood and no to killing and no to, as basic as they might sound, we're still not getting it. So I will still be spraying the no for a while.
Bahia Shahab is an artist and a historian of Islamic art. She talked with Charles Monroe Kane. Coming up, the legendary artist Frank Stella reflects on a lifetime of making art. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Frank Stella is one of America's greatest living artists. He's 81 years old, and he recently had a major retrospective that filled an entire floor of the Whitney Museum in New York. And then he had another major retrospective. This one focused just on his prints at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. Steve Paulson went to both shows. And Steve, I have to be honest, I didn't realize Stella even made prints.
Yeah, I mean, I think most people outside the art world don't even realize that. But you could actually make a case that he has been one of the major printmakers of the last century.
Because when I think of Stella, really what I think of is gigantic scale paintings, you know, the kind of thing that fills whole walls.
Yeah, and I mean, what's interesting is if you go back to early in his career, I mean, what really made his name in the early 60s was his so-called black paintings, and they weren't so huge. He kind of launched this minimalist movement within abstract art where, you know, you just looked at them and you thought, oh, they're just totally black. But no, there were actually black stripes in them. And then from there, I mean, this is part of the fascination with these retrospectives, is he went from these totally dark black paintings to these huge works of art in all kinds of media. I mean, not just paintings, but also sculptures that were filled with color, and they were just enormous in size.
Yeah, so a lot of people probably are thinking of those things that look like if you had a gigantic protractor
right.
and you drew a huge oval on the wall and then you filled it in with lime green and tangerine and Kool-Aid pink.
Yeah.
So what do the prints look like?
Well, the prints are they're fascinating because when I think of a print, I think of something that's flat.
It's a sheet of paper.
It's a sheet of paper. His prints are not like that. His prints are thick. I mean, there are some prints that actually stick out from the wall a good half a foot.
Huh.
They're three-dimensional. So, I mean, he's really kind of asking the question, what is a print?
Okay. Well, you had a chance to talk with him when he was here, and we're about to hear your interview. What else do we need to know before we hear it?
Well, and one of the things that fascinated me was, I mean, I'm always interested in what inspires artists. You know, where does the creativity come from? And, you know, given his subject matter, he's done stuff about Moby Dick, the novel, about jazz music, about race cars. I mean, it's sort of like interesting subjects. But when you actually ask him, you know, so where does the actual art come from? He'll talk about shapes and lines and circles and curves.
Geometry.
And geometry. Yes. It's like bringing math into art. Huh. And then the other thing that's kind of fascinating is at first he didn't even like prints. I mean, he had been this famous painter and he sort of he became a printmaker by accident.
I was encouraged by Ken Tyler, who was a printmaker and was printing in Gemini. And I was kind of lost in California for a while in 1967. And he wanted me, encouraged me or coerced me, I don't know, and he bullied me into trying to make prints. And I came up with a compromise that, you know, to make prints that was sort of like drawings. And I wanted to make it like a book, but it was kind of, you know, boring.
Hmm. Now, I think when most people think of a print, they think it's flat. It's two-dimensional. And the thing that is so striking about your prints is they don't look flat. I mean, I have to ask you about one that's in this show. It's from your Moby Dick series, Jonah Historically Regarded, which kind of extends way out from the wall.
Well, that's the pregnant, one of the pregnant things.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it seemed like it was an interesting idea, and the result is, I guess, okay, but it seems a little simple-minded to me now. But you have to make the paper form over another plate, which is a dome, and then etching on the dome.
How far does it actually extend out?
I never measured it. I don't know, but it's
like
it
half
seems
a foot
like
or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
right?
It's at least 6 inches. Might even be more. Yeah.
I want to ask you about your Moby Dick series, because you, for years, you did a series of, what was that, 135 pieces altogether?
Something like that. Actually, it's a lot more because I did a lot of them more than once, but that doesn't matter.
But in all different media, I mean, you did prints, you did metal reliefs, a sculpture. I mean, there was, what, a different piece for each chapter of the book?
Yeah, yeah. It started out when we were taking my kids, Peter and Patrick, to the, you know, parents have to face the weekend with their children one way or the other.
I know it well.
And so one of the things that we all seemed to like was to go to the aquarium at Coney Island. And right near the entrance was a very big glass wall, a big tank, and there were two belugas in there. And so, and they're very close to you. And, you know, it was all about movement, of course, but really form. So there's the thought, the water's moving and the animals are moving. So there's a lot of motion, but it's a kind of thing that has seems like a wave motion one way or the other. And so I was thinking about that a lot. And they're beluga, but they're whales. So then I started thinking about Moby Dick. And then I was talking to my older son and Michael, and I was saying, well, I was thinking about the book and about the wave forms, and I thought that it could go a long ways. And I said, but I thought, you know, it's 135 chapters. I don't know. It's kind of daunting. And, I don't know how it'll play out in terms of ideas and ability to carry out. He said, don't worry. You don't have to do them all. And I was so annoyed by that. I knew that I was going to, you know, do or die. There were going to be at least 135 pieces.
Did you get obsessed by the Melville
novel?
No,
I wasn't obsessed. I was annoyed by the idea that I didn't need to do them all, which is different from obsession.
It's interesting to hear you describe this. I mean, you're talking about sort of the form, maybe going back to that first moment of seeing mm-hmm. those beluga whales and sort of the waves and all of that, whereas I think mm-hmm. most people, when they think of the novel Moby Dick, I mean, it's the obsessive quest, the search for to find the elusive mythic whale. I mean, does that appeal
well,
to you
I
in
mean,
some way?
You know, in this case, the whale, it may not be the whale, it may be the elusive geometry. I mean, you know, the geometry is just as evil. You know, I mean, the interest in the wave started, I had a geometrical bent to begin with, and then so you go from the straight line, from rectilinear geometry to curved geometry, and then once you get there, you're into topology and differential geometry, and it's kind of a grim beast.
Well, and speaking of geometry, I mean, let's talk about your series, Circuits, I mean, based on race cars. I guess I'm wondering, I mean, you have these amazing prints of, you know, these sort of lines going in all kinds of different directions. And I was wondering, is this more an exercise in geometry or is it about speed?
You know, it's hard. I mean, racing is pretty grim and it's kind of simple. I mean, it is speed, but the speed is controlled by physics. I mean, there's only so much, you can only go so fast and stay on the track. But, I mean, the point of the prints is basically the routing of the shapes. So there, it's all about overlays, how the one shape is overlaid over the other. So it's the speed, the motion, and the places, and they're moving all the time, and you're following the circuits one on top of each other.
Hmm. Now, I heard that you actually have a race car in your studio. Is that right?
I have, yeah. I have a Ferrari that raced in the studio, yeah. But it raced, but it doesn't have – they sell the engine, so I don't have the engine. But I have a complete shell, yeah.
Wow. Is that like a source of inspiration for you?
Actually, it's not a source of inspiration, but it's serious in the sense that it's in the studio, so and everybody loves it when they see it. And if the work that you're making behind it can stand up to the attention that the Ferrari gets, then you know you're going in the right direction. And if it doesn't, you ought to think about it. I mean, it's a nice test, actually.
Yeah. I mean, why? Talk about the challenge.
I didn't do that deliberately, but that's the way it plays out.
Yeah. Do you like to drive fast?
You know, I got into being a poor driver, as it were, and a dangerous one, unfortunately, on the roads. In reality, my wife sentenced me to driving school, and I had to go with Hurley Hayward, a driver who's won Le Mans a few times, actually. Anyway, we went out on the track, and it's the track in Watkins Glen, and I had a Ferrari, and we went out on the track.
Is there any connection between sitting in a race car, going at that kind of speed, and what you do as an artist?
There are a couple of things. I mean, flat out, you know, so why shouldn't you work flat out? And then I do like some of the pithy sayings of the driver. Mario Andretti's one is my favorite. You know, if everything's under control, you're not going fast enough. That pretty much sums it up. And that's about, it's somewhat true of working too, you know, and what you're doing in the studio and everything. You know, if everything's organized, it's really this, that, and the other, you know, you're not getting there.
Now, one thing that's very striking about so much of your art, your prints as well as your paintings, is scale. I mean, so often you work big. You must like large scales.
Sometimes I like it because it's unpopular, or it seems like, you know, you go against the grain sometimes, you can't help it. But in some things like the protractor paintings, that was considered a big drag. But they didn't work any other way except if the form, which was a 5 by 10 foot, you know, protractor shape half circle, that was it. That was the unit. They needed to be that way. And you know, Larry Rubin, my dealer, he was always whining about there are no 10-foot, you know, there's no place to put 10-foot paintings in New York apartments. The ceilings are only 9 feet, and you hear about it. It's the end of the world and everything, but somehow you get through it. Yeah.
But I'm wondering, I mean, going back to what you said about having the Ferrari in your studio, you know, can the art sort of measure up to that? Is that partly why you've often done large works? I mean, it certainly grabs your attention.
You know, but that's not exactly, it's true. I mean, they might be a little bit exaggerated in scale, but you have to remember that I grew up, and the artist that I loved, and the only reason I became a painter is trying to make something somewhat like the artist that I admired the most. And, you know, one of the most obvious things about post-war painting, and particularly abstract expression, was what everybody talked about. You know, the easel painting was over and the mural scale painting was back or in. Actually, it was back, because if you go to like the Louvre or something, 19th century painting dwarfs most of the paintings we make.
Now, one of your famous sayings is, what you see is what you see. And
yeah.
You're probably sick of talking about this, but I'm wondering if what you see now is different than what you saw 30 or 50 years ago.
Yes and no. I mean, things are different, but I don't think I see them any differently, but I make different judgments. I mean, because sometimes if something doesn't strike you right, it's not so bad not to waste time worrying about why you don't like it. Michael Fried was a critic. You know, he was talking one time, he was saying, you know, it's so easy to say why you don't like something, but it's actually very hard to say why you do like something. And that's true.
Is it partly just because you can't always put it into words?
No, that would be nice to hide behind the words, but that's actually not the truth. If I can see it, it doesn't bother me that I don't have the words to explain it to somebody else. If I get it, I get it. It'll come out in my work if I need it or I want it.
We talked earlier about speed and race cars, and of course one element of speed is time. And I'm wondering how much you think about that in terms of what you do as an artist, it's sort of where you are in your career now. I mean, you're almost 80 years old.
Yeah, it's over. I mean, I get it. But, I mean, it doesn't bother
me. It's not over. I mean, you're still making art.
Yeah. Oh, no, I can go on. I suppose I go on for a while making art. But, I mean, it's not, you know, it's different. I mean, there's no future. in it. And so when you're young, you still have an idea of something other than the here and now. There is the future. But now I'm stuck with, as the physicists like to say, here and now. And that's it.
Do you feel the clock ticking?
No, I don't feel it like that. But I feel that there is nothing other than the moment, though. So you have to do it now.
That's artist Frank Stella talking with Steve Paulson. The retrospective exhibition of his prints was on display at the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art. So we've been talking about the visual arts this hour, but do these same aesthetic questions apply to other arts, like music? Well, coming up, the acclaimed jazz pianist Craig Taborn reflects on a lifetime of improvisation and how growing up in Minneapolis shaped his musical life. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. One of the greatest living pianists is a jazz musician named Craig Taborn. He doesn't have quite the same name recognition as someone like Keith Jarrett or Vijay Iyer, but he is revered by them. Taborn is in his late 40s. He's intensely private, and maybe he keeps that low profile deliberately, which might have something to do with his Midwestern roots or growing up black in Minnesota. But whether you've heard of him or not, Craig Taborn is someone to keep track of. If you listen to his recent solo album, Avenging Angel, or Daylight Ghosts, the new album he made with his quartet, you'll hear a musician reinventing the art of jazz improvisation. Steve Paulson is a huge fan, and he recently caught up with Taborn and found a guy who has turned music into a philosophical quest.
I'm so struck by the words that you use in your titles. There are religious references in a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Ghosts, spirits, saints, chants. That's not an accident, I'm sure.
No, it's not.
Are you expressing certain spiritual or metaphysical ideas in your music?
Probably not. I mean, I'm not particularly religious. But I think in many traditional cultures, the space for music came out of a ritual space, serving some kind of liturgical or spiritual process. I think it functions as a way to bridge into the unknown. I have a fascination for that utilization of music. I think largely it can still function that way, whatever that may mean. It could still be a bridge to some kind of heightened experience, other experience, or a way of connecting to things beyond. It always suggests to me like a liminal state, like the spaces between and all of that. And so I think the titles, things like ghosts and everything about that gets into the quicksilver spaces between things and what exists there, and I think sound sort of bridges that or the idea that sound can take you there if you listen, like even listening to a sound die away. And once you're engaged with that process, your imagination is sort of also engaged. Like a lot of times people continue to hear a sound very actively doing something even if it's died away. And I think that's all of interest.
So you're not only playing with sound, you're playing with silence as well.
Yeah, you're always playing with silence and you're playing with memory. That always strikes me more and more these days, is that music is really an art of memory in a very real way.
Do you mean memory in terms of evoking past music that other people have played, or memory?
Or the music that is just played, because the way sound works, I mean, you play a note and then that note's gone and then you've played the next note. And the concept of memory, the consequence of a melody, for instance, is really based on you remembering what the note that happened before was. You know, it's all memory. You never hear a whole piece at once. You can't.
That's so fascinating hearing you describe this, because I would think that for you, when you're playing, it's going to change depending on where you are in that particular moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, what that is evoking in you, I guess that's the wonder of improvisation. It's going to turn out differently every time.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on your own memories at that moment.
Exactly. And the audience, I mean, that's the thing. It's all imagination. You hear a note and you're like, oh, I like this melody. And then you can sing it back, but you're singing back your memory of what it sounded like. And it subtly shifts and alters even in that process. That stuff is really fascinating to me, because that is ultimately, you know, what's a ghost but that? You're still engaging with your memory of people who you had experience with, but they're not there.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to this idea that playing music can be a spiritual experience. Now, you said you're not a religious person, but I'm wondering if you feel transported, at least at times, while you're playing. Does it ever feel like an experience of transcendence?
Oh, often. I'm always connected to what's going on, and then at the same time, I'm not. I often don't remember much about what I've played. You know, the time seems to pass very quickly, and if you're really engaged in it, I don't have that many specific memories.
And you were just telling me that music is all about memory.
Yeah. I mean, so at that level, you're engaged with that. You definitely move to a different space that's not the same as sort of your waking everyday mind.
You have a musical voice as both a composer and a pianist like nobody else in jazz. It's not just your sense of melody and rhythm. There's some mysterious quality in your music, and it makes me wonder where this sound comes from. And I know this is a big question, but, you know, what is the essence of Craig Taborn's style?
Oh, that's a difficult question. Well, like many people, I'm the sort of sum total of my influences, and I think the way I was introduced to music, or the way I introduced myself to music, in particular with being interested in a lot of different kinds of music at an early age, like 12 years old, 13 years old, and listening to and going to see a lot of different kinds of music. Or
you're not just talking about jazz, you're talking about all kinds of different music.
Yeah, everything from contemporary classical music to hardcore punk rock or hip-hop or just anything. I very quickly got into extremely broad kind of span of music. From about 12 years old. I grew up in Minneapolis. There was a big rock scene there, and it sort of formed my sense of style or even what music could be, particularly with reference to jazz, was really complicated by that experience.
When did you start playing the piano?
When I was 12. So right around that time, everything sort of happened at once. My dad listened to music, but I didn't take an active interest until I decided for some reason to start piano.
Did your dad play music?
He played the piano for his own enjoyment. He was a psychologist.
And he's a university professor, right?
Mm-hmm. He was at University of Minnesota and did African-American Studies Department and psychology there.
Now, I mean, the other piece of this is that you were a black kid growing up in Minneapolis, which I'm assuming was a pretty white environment.
Mm-hmm.
And given what you just said about your dad, I mean, you know, chairman of the African-American Studies program at his school, I assume you were steeped in black culture. Do you think that influenced the art that you gravitated to?
The influence it had, I think, was one of having a strong sense of my own cultural identity. Being in Minnesota, where it wasn't, you know, so common, there weren't that many black people there, but you kind of had a strong sense of that. I mean, you know, like Prince or something like that is from there. Like, if I'm listening to early hip-hop, how could I be into speed metal? And then how could I be into either of those things and be going home and then practicing bebop? That might pose a problem for some people, yeah. But I think by, like, 14, I was just like, I don't care. This is what I'm doing.
Hmm. So when did you start to identify as a jazz musician?
Well, I think right away, playing piano and from my dad's influence, very quickly it seemed like jazz or improvisation in all its forms, which I just thought of as jazz, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was like the thing I kept wanting to do. But it meant a lot of different things, but I just liked improvising.
Now, one thing that a lot of very prominent jazz musicians have said about you, and this came out in a recent New York Times Magazine profile of you, people who all admire you tremendously, they wish that you would step out of the shadows a little bit more often, put your own stamp on your music rather than blending so much into the groups that you play with. What do you make of that reaction?
I'm just not so interested in performing in the sense of drawing attention to myself. I mean, I'm much more interested in what can be made out of the group. It's not...
You don't want to be playing with sidemen who are there just to accompany you. That's not what you're into.
No, I mean, if I'm there with another musician, I think we're all in it co-equally, and I like to really explore what music can be created if we are all equally focused in trying to make this thing happen.
I would think that kind of relationship you're describing with other musicians, let's say in one of your trios, is, I mean, you would really have to know those other musicians well. I mean, you'd have to have a history with them to really play that kind of music together in this profound way that you're describing.
Well, that certainly enhances it. I think the biggest thing that you gain out of knowing the other musicians is just trust. Because it's easy to get into a situation where you wonder if somebody's playing a certain way out of spite, you know, or out of
really?
Or out of confusion or out of fear or something. You know, it's very interesting. Just
what does that mean to be playing out of spite?
Some people, you know, like music's an interesting thing. You can work out a lot of issues through the music. And I've played with many musicians who might play something at you as an aggressive act. That can yield really interesting music. Sometimes it's more interesting if you know that it isn't going to be harmonious. That can be really, really useful.
Now, you also perform as a soloist.
Mm-hmm.
What are the trade-offs, playing solo versus in a group?
Well, all of these things that we've just been discussing, tensions, aggressions, microaggressions, harmony, trust... The problem is that you don't have anybody to have any of those experiences with. So you're sort of, I mean, that most of that stuff is the thing that actually feeds an improvisation. You just have something to react to or against or with. When you do a solo concert, you sit down and it's just you. The question is, where are you going to get your ideas? What in the environment is going to agitate enough that it gives you a new idea or something to react to? That's the question. For me, the solo thing is trying to answer that question continually. Mm-hmm. So that if you're really improvising, the idea is to try to have some new ideas occur. It could be very challenging, but the biggest trick is to give yourself things that stimulate your creative response. Without other musicians there, it's pretty tricky.
I would think the first time you ever did a fully improvised concert, whether solo or not, would be terrifying. Was it for you?
No.
No?
I think I was much more comfortable improvising, at least trusting in the moment and coming up with something.
It's one thing doing it in your own living room, but in front of an audience.
Yeah, on my first recital, you know, my first 2 years of piano were just sort of normal lessons. I think about my second year, I was taking from a classical teacher and I had a recital. He let me do an improvised piece. I think he was fascinated that I could do it. I'm sure it wasn't that great, but I did it and it didn't really worry me. You know, you can make certain things work. You have to have a certain risk tolerance anyway to engage in this, so.
So you must have a pretty high risk tolerance.
Yeah, or almost a risk need. Like, that's the thing. I think any improviser, that's the big difference, is it's risk tolerance isn't even an issue. It's like you're actively seeking out unstable situations.
That's jazz pianist Craig Taborn talking with Steve Paulson. His latest album is called Daylight Ghosts. That's it for our show today, but there's always more in our podcast feed. And if you're curious to know what goes into making this show, well, you could sign up for our newsletter. Every Friday, you'll get a note about the questions and ideas that drew us to our topic this week, plus notes about what each producer is reading and thinking about and listening to. We also share extended written features and audio extras, and there's just a whole lot packed into this one newsletter. To subscribe, head over to ttbook.org/newsletter. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Madison and the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our show is produced by Charles Monroe Kane, Halima Shah, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Ann Strainchamps. See you next time.